Welcome to Arts and Tech, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. I hope your day has gone well thus far. My name is Christopher Zhu, and for the next half hour, as usual, I'll be reading articles from MIT's Technology Review, this time the climate issue, which is the issue that has a pair of aviator sunglasses with flames in the lenses. With the caption, "Welcome to Climate Change, Mitigation, Adaptation, and Suffering." If you've been following us for the past couple of weeks, you'll know that we've finished mitigation, and we're just about to finish up adaptation, the chapter, the second possible response that a lot of climatologists, scientists, policymakers say that we can make to respond to climate change. There's one article that I'll just glance over real quickly. It's about Australian bushfires and how Australia is trying to adapt to a future with bigger and ever-worsening bushfires. The piece is called Code Red, but it is quite lengthy, but I feel like there's a few main points that we should touch on. The byline is, Australia is trying to adapt to a future with bigger, badder bushfires, but can it change quickly enough? This is written by Bianca Nograti. In 2013, three wildfires tore through the eucalyptus forest of the Blue Mountains, forcing 80,000 people to evacuate, including the author and her family. So this piece is called Code Red. Basically, the idea is a lot of prevention for bushfires in Australia doesn't work simply because their land is too arid, too dry, and too prone to wildfires. So Code Red is an admission that there are some blazes firefighters simply cannot tackle. Code Red signals that leaving your property is the best option for survival. Code Red means get out early rather than try to stay and defend your territory. And that ends up being a big problem for a lot of people and a lot of people who want to return home. So even though the government initiated a land buyback scheme for those who lost their homes in fires, few people want to relocate to safer territory, even if they've been traumatized by fire. So even though they've lost their homes, even though 550 homes were eligible for this buyback program, only 27 landowners actually took the offer. And so basically, there's been a lot of innovations as well in Australia with a lot of designers like Baldwin O'Brien Architects that design homes that are covered with soil and feature outward-facing windows that can easily be shuttered, and fire testing facilities include a gas-fired furnace for testing the resilience of new building materials. So there's a lot of innovation going on in this sector, especially in Australia, but those are some of the big hitting points for that article. The one I really wanted to get to, though, is this one, which honestly just has really cool graphics and also just sounds like a really cool story. It's titled How to Cool an Ocean, which seems rather like a tame, meek title to have. The byline is, climate change isn't just making the sea levels rise, it's making the oceans warmer. Now, some desperate geoengineering researchers are looking into ways to slow that catastrophic trend. And I always was kind of fascinated by the idea that our ocean can be a heat sink, you know, climes near major water sources like oceans. Some lakes are much more temperate in terms of their climate. And that's really an interesting fact. And also the images here, the main feature image here is this, I suppose, underwater cam of what looks to be some sea anemones, yes, and some other colorful rocks, and what looks to be some spiky fish, perhaps, floating in the background. It's kind of eerie, kind of ominous, sort of like the whole debate around climate change, a little bit of the unknown. But let's dive right into this. This is written by Holly Jean Buck. Coral reefs smell of rotting flesh as they bleach. The riot of colors, yellow, violet, cerulean, fades to ghostly white as the coral's flesh goes translucent and falls off, leaving their skeletons underneath fuzzy with cobweb-like algae. Corals live in symbiosis with a type of algae. During the day, the algae photosynthesize and pass food to the coral host. During the night, the coral polyps extend their tentacles and catch passing food. Just 1 degree Celsius of ocean warming can break down this coral algae relationship. The stressed corals expel the algae, and after repeated or prolonged episodes of such bleaching, they can die from heat stress, starve without the algae feeding them, or become more susceptible to disease. Australia's Great Barrier Reef, actually a 2,300-kilometer or 1,400-mile system made up of nearly 3,000 separate reefs, has suffered severe bleaching in the past few years. Daniel Harrison, an Australian oceanographer looking at what might be done to buy more time for the Great Barrier Reef, says the situation is getting dire. There might be as little as 25% of shallow water coral left over from pre-anthropogenic times. "We don't really know, because nobody started surveying before 1985. He tells me, "You've got less than 1% of the ocean in coral reefs and a quarter of all marine life. We're looking at losing all of that really quite quickly in evolutionary terms, in human lifetime terms." Coral reefs are not just about colorful fish and exotic species. Reefs protect coasts from storms. Without them, waves reaching some Pacific islands would be twice as tall. Over 500 million people depend on reef ecosystems for food and livelihoods. Even if the temperature increase eventually stabilizes at 1.5 degrees Celsius a century or two from now, it's not known how well coral reef ecosystems will survive a temporary overshoot to higher temperatures. "The corals are like the canary in the coal mine," Harrison says. "They're very temperature sensitive. I really do think it's just a harbinger of things to come. You know, the coral ecosystem might collapse first, but I think there might be quite a few more ecosystems that'll follow it. Life is very resilient, but ecosystems as we know them aren't." Arctic ecosystems, mountain glaciers, and redwood forests in California are also at high risk from even small changes in global mean temperature. So are species that can't move quickly and find another suitable niche. "It's the things that already live at the kind of extreme end of the scale, and they can't move, right?" says Harrison. So coral reefs, you know, they're stuck in already some of the warmest waters. If it gets too hot for them there, then A, they can't move, and B, they've got nowhere to go anyway. And the same with this, with the extremely cold ecosystems. And the same with the redwood forests. Trees can't keep up and move quickly enough to keep up with climate change. The salt sprayer. Harrison's working group formed teams to look at different ideas that could help the reef stay alive. For example, the ocean is full of cooler water at lower depths. They wondered if they could just pump some of that water upward, but realized it would be infeasible to move enough water to cool the whole reef. Instead, the researchers honed in on the idea of marine cloud brightening, a form of solar geoengineering, in that it increases the plant's reflectivity. Spraying tiny sea salt particles from seawater up into the low layer of clouds that blankets much of the ocean's surface would form cloud microdroplets. These droplets would then make the clouds reflect more sunlight and could also make them last longer, cooling the area. The modeling Harrison's team has done so far suggests that with this method, it might be possible to cool the water by between 0.5 and 1 degree Celsius. The Marine Cloud Brightening Project, an international collaboration led by atmospheric scientist Robert Wood and colleagues at the University of Washington, thinks that this could be a scalable approach. Kelly Wanser, a senior advisor to the project, describes other ways scientists are thinking of sustaining corals, such as genetically modifying or breeding them to withstand warmer waters, or moving robust corals into new areas and replanting them. But she says, the scale of the problem is like reinforcing the Rocky Mountains. It's massive. By contrast, brightening marine clouds is relatively simple. Essentially, it entails building devices to spray seawater. There's certainly some technical challenges to be overcome, but the basic process of just taking seawater and filtering it and then spraying it out at submicron size is not that difficult. Harrison's modeling suggests that there would probably need to be some stations a little way out at sea, just off the edge of the continental shelf, floating platforms or ships that would spray particles into the air. The whole project could cost $150 to $300 million per year. Expensive, but then the reef brings in an estimated $6 billion each year to the Australian economy. In Harrison's conception, you wouldn't even need to brighten the clouds all the time or even every summer. Rather, it would be done when the coral was at risk of bleaching, which would require about 2 weeks of forewarning to cool the water down to the maximum extent. But, I mean, there's some real unknowns here, right? Harrison says, because no one's ever done any field work on this. Even though the engineering might be relatively simple, it's hard to know how well marine cloud brightening would work, because clouds are really complex. If you look out the window on an airplane, you can see clouds with all sorts of different structures, says Ben Kravitz of Indiana University, who works on comparing geoengineering model simulations. They're moving, some of them are a couple meters across, some of them are tens of kilometers across, some of them are organized, some are not. Basically, you cannot fit all that behavior in any single model. Adding to this complexity are, quote, teleconnections in the climate system. That is, clouds in one place affect weather in another place. When you're trying to cool large areas, these long-distance effects are relevant. That's why, quote, it scares me the thought of doing marine cloud brightening, says Anthony Jones, a climate scientist at the University of Exeter. The teleconnections are almost unavoidable, and if you can cool a certain area significantly, you are going to change the climate and the weather response. Newer climate models may yield better estimates of how effective marine cloud brightening could be. Wanser of the Marine Cloud Brightening Project says the next step is to build and test nozzles for spraying seawater, but it's been difficult to raise funding because the project is seen as a geoengineering experiment and people are fearful of geoengineering. I think we talked to all of the relevant government agencies who could support this, and essentially there's no one willing to say, we'll just do it as the cloud aerosol basic science. They're like, no, the cat's out of the bag. This is geoengineering. We would have to get approval. So cloud brightening is a technique that might help save marine ecosystems, but we don't know how well it would work. And we can't find out because the stigma of geoengineering makes it hard to get research funding. Luckily, it isn't the only option for trying to cool the oceans. The seaweed forests. Trees suck up carbon dioxide, and so planting masses of new forests has been proposed as a way to lower carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere and thereby cool the earth. But there's only so much land available. Enter ocean afforestation, a concept outlined in a 2012 paper by Antoine de Ramon-Nur of the University of the South Pacific and colleagues. This proposal for cultivating seaweed for carbon removal has several steps. First, the seaweed needs to grow and be harvested. Then it's put into an anaerobic digester, a large oxygen-free tank that breaks the organic material down. That produces biogas, which is about 60% methane and 40% CO2. The methane can be used as a biofuel, while the carbon dioxide needs to be stored to keep it from going back into the atmosphere. One idea is to store it inside a tube that would rest on the seafloor, though it could also be injected underground. The advantage of using seaweed in this way is that it's fast-growing and doesn't require dry land, so it won't be competing with food production or forests. Neuer and his fellow researchers calculated that afforesting 9% of the world's ocean surface and processing the resultant biofuels could replace fossil fuel energy, increase sustainable fish production, and remove 553 billion tons of CO2 from the atmosphere each year. With current emissions at about 40 billion tons a year, this could mean actually lowering the CO2 level overall. Quickly implementing ocean afforestation would be an effort on the order of putting a man on the moon, but both less expensive and likely a much better return on investment. But such an effort requires coordination from multiple scientific and engineering fields to even form demonstration projects. There aren't institutions that work on this kind of holistic research and development. On the other hand, as with cloud brightening, the basic technology of ocean afforestation is pretty simple. It requires advances in things like low-energy techniques for growing and harvesting seaweed, efficient gas separation, and carbon capture and storage, all building on things that we already know how to do. The U.S. government's Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy has a $22 million program called MARINER, an acronym for Macroalgae Research Inspiring Novel Energy Resources. I am amazed at who comes up with these acronyms. It's for exploring innovations that could kickstart a seaweed industry. Seaweed cultivation can have other benefits too, such as cleaning up agricultural pollution. Fertilizer runoff from industrial agriculture pours nitrogen and phosphorus into the oceans. A 2017 paper in Nature Scientific Reports said that China's seaweed industry already moved 75,000 tons of nitrogen and 9,500 tons of phosphorus from coastal waters each year, and that just 150% more seaweed cultivation could remove all the phosphorus flowing in the Chinese coastal waters, though much more would be needed to deal with the excess nitrogen. To capture these benefits, we'll need a well-designed system, but right now the industry is mostly unregulated. Why does seaweed need regulating? For one thing, to prevent the spread of invasive species or diseases. For example, a bacterial disease called ice infects a red seaweed called Capophycus, turning its branches into ghastly white icicles. The disease caused millions in crop losses in the Philippines and then spread to farms in Tanzania and Mozambique. Another challenge is how to make seaweed farming an explicit part of climate policy. The definition of a carbon sink under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was written for trees. It doesn't quite fit the profile for seaweeds. The carbon they draw down is easily decomposed and released again. Of course, there are ideas about how to sequester the biomass, sinking it into the deep sea or into submarine canyons. But the current UN policy means that seaweed will primarily be cultivated for food, biofuels, and other products, rather than with carbon sequestration expressly in mind. Yet another obstacle in using seaweed for carbon removal is climate change itself, which is already decimating natural kelp forests, for instance. One scientific report describes the urchin barrens that are settling in where kelp forests used to be. These warm water species mow down everything in their path. Apparently, they are, quote, almost immune to starvation, and some species live for over 5 decades. When they are stressed by hunger, their jaws and teeth actually enlarge, and they form fronts that march across the seafloor hunting for food. There's just one instance of how climate change makes all kinds of agriculture trickier: putting the brakes on glaciers. Besides upsetting ecosystems, the ocean warming will, of course, raise sea levels. They're already 13 to 20 centimeters higher than in 1900. In the 20th century, most of this rise came from ocean waters expanding as they got warmer, but now the effects of melting glaciers and ice sheets have far overtaken thermal expansion. The rise produced by melting glaciers is projected to be staggering, on the orders of meters per century. But what if we could engineer specific glaciers to keep them from melting? John Moore, a glaciologist and leader of China's geoengineering research program, has recently been looking into this, and he wrote a column with colleagues in Nature that outlines a few ways to do it. One example involves two Antarctic glaciers scientists have a nervous eye on, Pine Island and Thwaites. Warm ocean water comes in underneath them. Conventional wisdom says this is unstoppable and irreversible because of the bedrock slope and geometry. But Moore suggests that building artificial islands in front of the glaciers could buttress them, pinning down the ice and holding it back the way natural rocks and islands do. Another technique would be extract water from below the glaciers to help keep them from sliding off into the ocean. Glaciers sit on subglacial streams or thin layers of water, but drying these streams could slow their slide into the sea. Moore says he sees this as a very democratic, egalitarian way of dealing with sea level rise. Instead of trying to build walls around the world's coastline, which actually means the rich countries will do it more than the poor countries, of course, you can deal with the problem at the source. Where you have something on the scale of 100 kilometers to deal with, instead of tens of thousands of coastline to deal with. The engineering expertise exists, he says. Look at things such as the construction of the Suez Canal or the building of Hong Kong's new airport. When we've talked about this with glaciologists, there's a lot of horror at first, Moore adds. Clearly, you're going to have to put some people in Antarctica with a lot of stuff. That definitely will mess with the environment and the ecology. But if you compare it to the damage due to the collapse of the ice sheet, that's kind of dwarfed. Living in the ruins. Moore's ideas might just be a thought experiment for now, but we need more thought experiments. Reckoning with geoengineering in all its forms means coming to terms with loss. To explore what it means to, quote, live in the ruins, in anthropologist Anna Singh's phrase. Geoengineering comes as a shock to the mind of people who don't currently feel as if they are living in the ruins, who have yet to come to terms with the losses being experienced. In Beijing, though, where Moore lives, it's different, particularly because of air pollution. There's no denial. Everyone can see what we're doing, he says. We've made this mess. We should clear it up. You can't rely on nature to do it. The writer Holly Jean Buck is a fellow at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. This is an adapted excerpt from her upcoming book, After Geoengineering, Climate Tragedy, Repair and Restoration, due out September of this year, actually. Very cool, very cool. Actually, I didn't think that article would take a turn towards seaweed. We hear a lot about seaweed for nutritional purposes. I wouldn't say it's necessarily being heralded as a superfood, but it's on there. It's on there. A lot of people really like the idea of what kelp can bring to the human diet. So next up, we have a really interesting, I think, question and answer session with one of a major climatologist in the U.S. and his predictive models for what the future of climate change holds for us. It's called How Bad Will It Be? One of the biggest sources of climate uncertainty is how clouds will behave. Tapio Schneider's powerful new model should give us some answers, by Mallory Pickett. The severity and speed of climate change will depend on the quantity of greenhouse gases we emit into the sky, but also on how sensitive the climate is to those gases. One uncertainty is how clouds will respond as the atmosphere heats up. Tapio Schneider, a climate scientist at Caltech, and his colleagues from Caltech, Princeton, JPL, and MIT, are building a climate model that will use machine learning, powerful computing, and petabytes of data to help resolve some of the unknowns around why, how, and where clouds form, produce precipitation, or dissipate. The goal is to cut the uncertainty in current predictions of carbon dioxide's impact on the planet in half. Science journalist Mallory Pickett sat down with Schneider to find out how his research will do this and why it matters. How much uncertainty is there in current climate models? There is a measurement called climate sensitivity. It's the global mean surface temperature increase that you get after doubling CO2 concentrations and letting the system equilibrate. With current climate models, the climate sensitivity for doubling CO2 ranges somewhere between 2 degrees Celsius warming up to 5 degrees warming. So question, what are the implications? The answer is, well, take the 2 degree target of the Paris Agreement. We've had about 1 degree of warming already, so it's one more degree to go. How much more CO2 can we put into the atmosphere before we have warmed Earth another degree? For a model that has a climate sensitivity of around 2 degrees, you can get to CO2 concentrations of close to 600 parts per million. We're at 410 parts per million, so even if we continue emitting a lot, we won't reach 600 before 2060 or so. In a model that has a climate sensitivity closer to 5 degrees, one more degree requires about 480 parts per million, and that's only about 70 to go. That's something we'll reach in the next 2 decades or so. The question is, why the certain uncertainty? The single biggest contributor is uncertainties about clouds, and specifically about low clouds in the tropics. Low clouds over tropical oceans reflect sunlight because they are white, and this cools the Earth. We don't know if we'll get more or fewer of them as it warms, and that's the key uncertainty in climate predictions. One other important piece is how much carbon is being taken out of the biosphere. Right now, only about half the carbon that humans emit ends up in the atmosphere. The rest is taken up by oceans and the land biosphere, and we don't quite know where it goes. Well, question, if there's so much uncertainty, do we really even know that things will get bad with a lot of CO2? Well, when you put more CO2 or other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, they absorb thermal radiation. What happens if you put more of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere is that everything else being equal, you ought to warm the surface. The physics of that is completely clear, undisputed by any serious scientist. Where the uncertainties come in is to say, well, how much warmer will it get? What happens to these little clouds? They reflect a lot of sunlight. If we get more of them and more sunlight will be reflected, it will be less warming. If you get fewer of them, you have an amplifying feedback effect where you get more warming. So are things worse than predicted? I think the evidence in recent years, for example, from studies looking at cloud variations of the past decades, points more towards higher climate sensitivity. The goal is to cut some of these uncertainties in half. How will you do that? We want to use the data we have available, terabytes per day coming down from satellites. We want to assimilate those data into the model. That's a computationally challenging task, but it's doable now and will give you a model that simulates the present climate better. If climate sensitivity is on the high side, how worried should we be? I would be very worried. It would mean higher heat extremes, especially in summer. It would mean more extreme precipitation in places like the US Northeast. It is possible that climate sensitivity is on the high end of what models predict, and if that's right, then we'll experience severe impact in our lifetime, certainly in our children's lifetimes. Simply put, the higher the climate sensitivity, the more worried we should be. Kind of drab, like most of what I talk about climate change is. And to just continue on that theme, here's another update on the Must Do Better Planetary Health Report card that we talked about last week. This week, our grade for boost underused crops, so to kind of use more of the crops that we don't, because 75% of the world's food comes from just 12 plants and 5 animal species, so 17 out of 300,000 known edible plants. So corn, soy, wheat, and rice dominate global agriculture and research. We need more development and production of underused crops like fruits and nuts with a focus on improved varieties that have higher yields and resistance to disease and pests. Brent Loken, the Commission's Director of Science Translation, says we must increase production of legumes by 200%, nuts and seeds by 150%, and fruits by up to 75%. Currently, we are given a D+ in boosting underused crops. Now, one of the two only Fs here is changing fertilizer use. Bard College Environmental Physics Professor Gideon Eschel says, "We are far from where we need to be as we can possibly be. U.S. farms especially need to drastically reduce fertilizer use, while many farms in many other areas of the world where yields are a fraction of what they could be need to use more. Precision agriculture technologies under development can help farmers pinpoint the right amounts, but it's still too expensive for many." Then optimizing land use, D+. Growing more food is crucial, but much of the world's land is difficult to farm today. Research could focus on improving these tough environments. For example, large-scale mapping of soil characteristics could uncover areas that hold more promise for food production and spot those better suited to conservation. Optimizing where we grow is a, quote, absolute necessity, says Loken. You've got to select the right crop, plant at the right time, in the right place. And the next, increasing seafood production, we have a C on, which is actually one of the highest grades we have here. Wild catches are exhausted, but the world needs more supply, particularly of farmed oysters and other bivalves. Norway has been making progress on sustainable salmon farming, but new aquaculture technologies are still in their infancy. What happens when antibiotic use is increased? Where does the feed come from? What happens if genetically modified fish escape into wild populations? Nobody is quite sure. And with that, it's about time to wrap up this week's Arts and Tech segment. Thank you so much for listening to Arts and Tech. If you have any questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. Have a wonderful and safe day or night whenever and wherever you may be listening to this program. Stay knowledgeable and stay curious. This program will be replayed after 9 p.m. this evening. My name is Christopher Zhu, signing off from our radio. Until next time.